Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, a weekly mix of science, interviews, and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, killer asteroids, sky-watching five planets, ocean gyres, and natural gas fracking. Here's a scientist soundbite.
The thing I would like to be clear is that science really works. That is, you can actually predict the motion of a spacecraft, the motion of an asteroid, the motion of the Earth.
You're listening to mathematician Andrea Milani of the University of Pisa in Italy. Dr. Milani is an expert on tracking killer asteroids, and he heads one of only two groups in the world that calculate the odds an asteroid will impact the Earth. Dr. Milani, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us about the work you've done in calculating risk to Earth from the hundreds of thousands of asteroids in space.
Well, of course, the number of asteroids is not properly defined unless you speak of size. So as an example, the asteroids which can cross the orbit of the Earth and which are larger than 1 kilometer is only about 1,000. So at this point, we have a quite good hold on them in the sense that we know essentially more than 80% of them. And we know that this 80% we know is not going to hit us in the next 100 years or so. Others, there are many more smaller ones. And this is not possible to know them all. We are progressing, but it's not possible to know everything about all the objects down to a few tens of meters. But at least the effect of having found the biggest one effectively decreases the risk, because the smallest one may still hit us, but the amount of damage they could do is quite minor. Also, we are to some extent protected by the atmosphere. So it is estimated that if an asteroid is less than about 40 meters, unless it is metallic like the meteor crater one, does not get to the ground and therefore makes a big firework in the atmosphere, which is not necessarily dangerous. So we have still work to do to decrease the risk, but in reality, most of the work has been done already in the last 20 years or so.
What about the possibility that there's a surprise asteroid out there that scientists don't know about?
That's what I was saying, in a way. I mean, of the object we have already discovered, we can compute whether they hit the Earth or not. Of the ones we have not discovered, we don't know, which means they can still come upon us by surprise. So the goal is precisely to reduce this uncertainty by observing, by investing in telescopes and computers and in the work of qualified people in such a way that we know more and more, and the ones which are completely unknown and therefore can take us by surprise are less and less.
Is there something in the data on asteroids that keeps you up at night, in a sense, with concern?
Well, at this moment, no. What happened is that one particular object, which is called Apophis, in 2004, more precisely, it was Christmas 2004, had been just discovered, and we did not have much data. Our results were not as quantitative as we would have liked, and therefore we were not in position to exclude that it would impact the Earth in 2029. And the probability of this event, as computed by the data we had at that time, was very large. It was like 1 in 37, like zero at the roulette. Everybody loses. And then, a few days after Christmas, new data arrived, which allowed us to exclude the possibility of an impact in 2029. Now, this same asteroid has still the possibility of impacting the Earth, as an example, in 2036, but that is much less likely. So, honestly, I don't think it may be considered threatening in this moment. However, this is the one asteroid who gave us the worst fright in our work in this field.
Dr. Milani, where do you place astronomers' understanding of the cosmos in relation to the immense waves of new data coming in from new missions and instruments? Are astronomers behind the curve of new data?
Well, honestly, I don't think that the problem is that we cannot cope with the data. I think the problem is another one, is that data might be the product of increasing investment in technology. And then you need the scientists to look at the data and see what they contain. So if you make a very large investment in something like a new big telescope, a new satellite, and then you don't pay the people who have to do the job of looking at the data, you essentially are wasting the effort. You should not believe that it is enough to build wonderful toys if you don't make the necessary investment, which in the end is investment in human brains, in trained people, in qualified and educated people who work with dedication to extract the real value from the brute data. And this might be the thing is missing. It's not that we couldn't process the data. To be clear, as coming from the example we are providing, is that science really works. That is, you can actually predict the motion of a spacecraft, the motion of an asteroid, the motion of the Earth. There are a lot of things we can model with very great detail and which we can describe and predict with extreme precision. So science is a tool of understanding.
You've been listening to mathematician Andrea Milani of the University of Pisa in Italy. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
In the morning, I'm feeling all right. Open my eyes and my wings will take flight. Hear the words and the wind blows my ear. All that I'm needing and wanting to hear. All the land just looks perfect to me. Things that I'm wanting to say and to see. Close my eyes cause I'm feeling okay. There is no spinning in my head today. And I'll be digging up dirt and covering stones. Follow the dirt all the way down to the bone. I'll be digging up dirt and covering stones. Follow the dirt all the way down to the bone.
Find us on Facebook as Earth Sky, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and we're at earthsky.org. Beth Lebel has a story on the science of something called ocean gyres. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you, Jorge. So I am here today to tell you about ocean gyres. And to find out more about them, I spoke to Dr. Manu DiLorenzo, who is an ocean expert at Georgia Institute of Technology.
Yeah, so Beth, what are ocean gyres?
Well, they are giant rotating masses of water. So imagine the coffee spinning in your coffee cup, except imagine that on the scale of an ocean basin. For example, Dr. DiLorenzo studies the North Pacific Gyre, whose diameter is about 12,000 kilometers across. That's the distance between the United States and Japan, again, approximately. And depending where you are on Earth, that mass can either rotate in a clockwise direction or a counterclockwise direction.
The reason that we use the word gyres, as opposed to simply using the word currents, is that these water masses rotate on the scales of the entire oceanic basin.
Okay, so there is no simple explanation of why we have these gyres. That said, scientists do know that there are a couple of factors that contribute to their formation, okay? So the first is the rotation of the Earth, and it sort of makes sense as our Earth spins, ocean waters move too. But if you add to that our sun, which heats the atmosphere, and that helps create surface winds, and that in turn, through friction, moves ocean masses, okay? So we've got A, the rotation of the Earth, and B, the heat of the sun, which, through its impact on wind, affects ocean water and its movement. And the third factor is actually the continents themselves. It's like the edges of a bathtub. It affects the movement of the water inside of it just by virtue of containing it, if that makes any sense.
Yes, scientists are just beginning to understand these really large-scale movements of water in our oceans.
Yeah, I think that's very well said, because these gyres are actually not terribly well understood.
Ultimately, there's really no simple explanation of why we have these oceanic gyres.
So Dr. DiLorenzo also explained to me that these gyres are actually pretty important to study because they're connected to not only the health of our oceans. He actually compared ocean gyres to sort of the arteries of the human body. You know, they carry around heat, they carry around nutrients, they to some extent carry around plants and animals.
If you think of the human body and you have the bloodstream that carries all the nutrients and energy for the body, then you can think that the ocean gyres also carry around the water masses with nutrients that are vital for the survival of the ocean living systems. And here I'm referring to things like fish, corals, and a variety of different marine ecosystems. So if you actually didn't, and this is, you know, for the living ocean, and then from a non-living ocean, the gyres transport around, you know, the heat that comes from the sun. And so that's also very important. And that's very important in terms of understanding the role of the ocean in climate. Especially nowadays that we talk a lot about climate change, you know, the movement of heat in the ocean is very important in that context.
Yeah, so scientists are just beginning to understand these huge ocean currents and ultimately how they affect people everywhere. Thanks, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Join us on Facebook for Conversations on Science. You can find us as Earth Sky. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about the global night sky and something special, sky-watching planets in June. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Jorge. You can see all five of the visible planets in the month of June 2011. And by visible planets, I mean planets that you can see with the unaided eye. You don't need a telescope or binoculars. And you can see these planets from any part of the globe.
Wow. So tell us about these planets. What are we looking for?
Well, first of all, there are two planets that are going to be in the evening sky. The first one is in the evening sky all month. It's the planet Saturn. If you're in the northern hemisphere, say in the U.S. or Europe, you're going to be looking in the southern sky as soon as the sun goes down. Saturn is pretty bright. It's the faintest of the bright planets, but it's pretty bright. It's brighter than most stars. And it happens to be close to another object that is a star, the star Spica in the constellation Virgo. So looking south from the northern hemisphere, looking north from the southern hemisphere, if you're at the equator, you're looking more or less overhead in the evening to see the planet Saturn.
And what about other planets?
Well, the planet Mercury, which is the innermost planet in our solar system, sometimes called the most elusive planet because it always stays near the sun in our night sky, is going to be visible in the month of June 2011 toward the end of the month. So Mercury passes on the far side of the sun, as seen from Earth, in about mid-June. And then by the end of June, we're going to see the planet Mercury reemerge into the evening sky, the western sky after sunset. At the end of June, the very last day of June, the two brightest stars in the constellation Gemini, which are the stars Castor and Pollux, will be pointing right at Mercury.
And what about a star many people are familiar with, the morning star, Venus?
Well, Venus is not always the morning star, Jorge. Right now, it is the morning star. But sometimes Venus is the evening star. So Venus is an evening planet too, like Mercury, and it switches between the evening and the morning sky. It is up before the sun now, as is the planet Mars and the fifth visible planet, which is the planet Jupiter. So Jupiter and Venus are very, very bright. They're both in the east before dawn, as seen from around the globe. Mars is much fainter, but it's located between Venus and Jupiter. So if you're standing there looking at the eastern sky before dawn and you see two very bright objects, the upper one is Jupiter, the lower one is Venus, and if you look generally between them, you might see a faint reddish dot, and that'll be the planet Mars.
This is a fantastic time to see our planet neighbors.
That's right. And by the way, Jorge, at the end of the month, the moon is going to be passing by those planets in the early morning sky. So mark your calendar beginning around June 25th, all the way through the end of the month. You'll see the waning crescent moon going past the planets. It'll be very beautiful early morning scenes.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky is Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
Highlighted what we think is a fundamental problem with methane contamination, at least in the area that we've worked. The most important thing now is to ask, how general is that issue? How can we fix it? And how can we make shale gas extraction better and safer? That's our ultimate goal.
You're listening to Rob Jackson, an environmental chemist at Duke University. Dr. Jackson led a study published in May of 2011 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the U.S. This study, the first of its kind, found evidence of methane contamination in groundwater from a practice called fracking, short for hydraulic fracturing. Fracking extracts natural gas from deep in the ground by pumping fluids into rock fractures and forcing gas up to wells that collect it. Here to talk more about the fracking study is Rob Jackson. Welcome, Dr. Jackson.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what is the main finding of your study of whether hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, contaminates drinking water?
We asked a couple of questions. The first question was, if you lived near a natural gas well, were you more likely to have problems or evidence of contamination in your drinking water? The answer to that question was yes for methane concentrations of gas, and no for fracking fluids. We also asked, where did the methane come from? Was it more like shallow methane that would occur naturally, or deeper methane that's found underground coming out of a gas well? And using chemical or isotopic signatures, we showed that the methane in people's water was more like a deep underground source.
How much methane in this drinking water are we talking about here?
We found concentrations as high as 64 milligrams of methane per liter. That's extremely high enough to be a flammability and explosion hazard.
What is fracking?
There are two steps in the process of drilling and exploiting a shale gas formation. The first step is the drilling itself. A company might drill down a mile and then horizontally drill a mile or two sideways. In addition, the companies typically hydraulically fracture or frack the wells. And once you have the well in place, imagine injecting water and chemicals into that well under high pressure, and the pressure of that fluid cracks or causes fissures in the shale, and those tiny cracks and fissures allow the gas to flow more quickly back to the wellbore.
Tell us more about where you did your study and maybe why you chose that area.
We sampled five counties in the states of New York and Pennsylvania, four in Pennsylvania and one in New York. These are all in the Marcellus Formation, an area that's been exploited rapidly, is growing quickly for shale gas. We worked in this area because there has been a lot of controversy over drinking water issues, and we simply wanted to ask the question, was there any relationship between how near you were to a gas well and the quality of your water?
How is methane getting in the drinking water, and what are these fracturing fluids that you're talking about?
We don't know the precise mechanism of how the methane is migrating into the water. The simplest explanation would be through gas well casings that leak, that might have cracks in them near the surface, but we simply don't know.
I got one more question from Twitter here. Earthworks Rocks asks, please ask Dr. Jackson to address the lack of baseline measurements and how design of the study accounted for it.
Baseline sampling is always desirable because you want to see how someone's well water quality changes through time. We weren't able to go back in time in the study to do that. We do have a baseline now that we're using, and we're going back this summer to see how some wells have changed. My analogy to this is smoking and studies of lung cancer and smoking. In a perfect study, you would follow people through time before they smoke and then watch how their health changes after that, after they start smoking. That's not easy and not the thing that scientists did first. What scientists did first was to ask, if you smoke, are you more likely to get cancer? It doesn't prove cause and effect. It suggests that something fundamental is going on, and from there you need follow-up work. That's what I would say about our study. Our results suggest that there's something fundamental going on, and we need follow-up studies to pursue the actual mechanism that's causing this.
That was Rob Jackson, the Nicholas Chair of Global Environmental Change at the Nicholas School of the Environment and a professor in the biology department of Duke University. That's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week, we recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Our audio engineer is Eddie Campos. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Vanessa Lively, Royal Forest, 100 Flowers, and the Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.